think of all the possibilities that an RV brings. Hi there, folks. Cher Lichtman here, Mike Thompson RV in Cathedral City. We sell all of the top RV brands in the country, and we pride ourselves on finding you the RV of your dreams. Imagine being out there in the campgrounds and on the open road in a safe, affordable RV from Mike Thompson RV in Cathedral City. Come let us show you the meaning of customer delight. Visit us at 68318 Palm Canyon Drive in Cathedral City or call us at 760-324-3651.
It's our golden anniversary. Eisenhower Health is celebrating 50 years with this wonderful community. From the day we opened our medical center back in 1971, we've done all we can to keep our relationship meaningful. We've created a valley-wide network of primary and specialty care clinics, recruited exceptional physicians and staff, invested in advanced technologies, and worked to meet your changing healthcare needs, from developing our renowned robotic surgery program to providing specialty care for the LGBTQ community. We expanded our cancer program to provide advanced services through our affiliation with UC San Diego Health. We became an accredited teaching hospital to attract talented new physicians to the area. And we continue to earn certifications, awards, and high rankings for quality and safety. So here's to us, to you, and to the next 50 years. Learn more at EisenhowerHealth.org.
If you can't get in to see your doctor as soon as you'd like, Desert Oasis Healthcare has you covered with four conveniently located immediate care clinics. Your health and well-being is our top priority. We follow all CDC guidelines for safety. Desert Oasis Healthcare members can call our patient helpline 24/7 at 760-969-6555. Find out why we say your health, your life, our passion.
From the Joey English Show, here is this hour's mystery song.
Okay, Joey pals, in honor of our special guest, Michelle Rubini, we're playing a song that the Wrecking Crew worked on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain.
We all know this, don't we? Were you on this record?
Yes, of course.
Yes, of course I was.
Be playing organ.
Charleston was once the rage. History has turned a page. The miniskirts, the current thing. Goes on.
Thanks, Nigel. Oh, that's wonderful. Tell us a story about that recording, Michelle.
Well, the beat goes on. I became involved with playing on records in L.A., and I started becoming popular with the different arrangers and producers a little at a time. You know, I started making my first record around 1961, something like that, you know, playing on demo records and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, as it turned out, I wound up playing on every hit record that Sonny and Cher ever had. And that happened to be one of the records, you know. It wasn't their first record, but but one of many. And by the time their careers went a little sour around 1969 or so. They had lost their popularity, and they started playing in clubs and small venues around the country. They had a contract with Hugh Hefner from the Playboy Club. He sort of kept them out of financial ruin. He was paying them $5,000 a week to play in his clubs, and he would send them to the different clubs. But they got a chance to be the hosts of the Johnny Carson show one night, and they did so well on that, that Johnny brought them back again, and the powers that be at that station, I guess it was NBC, thought to themselves, you know, these, they're so well received that they could do, they thought that they could do a summer replacement show called the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour. And they had, Sonny and Cher had developed their comedy routine in that down period when they were going around playing in clubs where they just didn't walk on stage and sing their hit records and walk off. They had to talk to the audience, you know, and say thank you for the applause, et cetera. And Cher had developed this knack of making fun of Sonny as his height or, or ethnicity or whatever it was. It was very sarcastic.
Yes.
And the audience,
to say the least.
Yes. And the audience loved that. And when they did that act on the Johnny Carson show, you know, it really sold the programmers there. And so they got their show. Well, now it was, all of a sudden they went from being nowhere to having their own television show. And Sonny came to me because I'd played with him, you know, on all their records, and I had a personal relationship, you know. I mean, not, we didn't go out for dinner and stuff like that, but a very close business friendship relationship. And he came to me and he said, you know, Michelle, he said, I've got a chance, we've got a chance now to really become big stars again. And he said, I'm going to need a music guy. He said, I need someone that can take care of all my music.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said, you've played on all our records. You know how we you know how we sing. And he said, so he said, I'd like you to be my music guy. Would you consider that? And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, yes.
A minute. A very quick minute.
Well, no, it wasn't that quick.
Oh, really?
No, because I had a whole career going as a studio musician, and I had to weigh giving up, because the minute you're not around to when you get called to play on a recording session, if you're not there, they don't cancel the session. They go to the next player down the list. You know, they've got a list of 10 piano players. I may be at the top, but if I'm not available, they go to number two. If he's not, they go to number three, because that session has to go on. So I knew that I would be losing sessions if I, you know, started doing this job, and I had to weigh that very carefully. But Sonny made it worth my while. And he said, you can always do sessions when we're not on tour, you know, when I don't need you or something like that. And as it turned out, which I didn't see at the moment, you know, they can't tour all the time. You know, it wears them out. So and also they had to do the TV show. So we weren't out on the road that much. You know, mainly it was in the summertime where we would do this whole circuit of county fairs around the country. Mm-hmm. So it didn't interfere with my other work, you know, too much.
But I have to pay you a compliment. You went from being your father's classical pianist accompanist to his violin to playing, you know, for the top pop group in the world at that time. Was that a big change?
Oh, it was a huge change.
Hello?
And my father hated it.
Oh, I bet he did.
Yeah, no, I had the same father-son problems that every son has. My father wanted me to follow in his footsteps. And, you know, it really wouldn't have made any difference how successful I became as a musician in my own right. It would never be good enough for him, because he wanted me to be the next Liberace. He wanted me to be some sort of giant, you know, musical star. And that wasn't in the that wasn't in the books for me, you know.
I've got a little list. Listen, Joey pals, let me just rattle off some names, and then I've got a question. Richie Valens, The Byrds, The Fifth Dimension, The Mamas and the Papas, The Monkees, Glenn Campbell, Wayne Newton, Sam Cooke, Tijuana Brass, Ray Charles, Cher, James Bond theme, Dick Clark, Brian Wilson, Phil Spector. Now, explain to Joey pals the difference. You could do things with the Wrecking Crew in 3 hours that would take regular musicians 3 weeks to do. Sight reading, doing it great on one take. What kind of special talent is that, and how do you get it? Or are you born with it? Can you learn it?
Well, you have to learn. So obviously, you have to learn. But if you don't have talent for this thing, to be a musician, you're never going to go anyplace. And people that didn't have the talent, they just never got anywhere. So what are you asking me? What qualities did it
there's
take?
There's a difference in the Wrecking Crew as studio musicians.
Okay. Well,
and an orchestra that you'd hire at the Carnegie Hall or something.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. The Wrecking Crew, or more broadly, the studio musicians, mm-hmm. all of them that worked in L.A., and still work there, are the best musicians in the world. They're just, nobody competes. Horowitz may be the best pianist in the world, and I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. But he could never do what the studio musicians do in Los Angeles. These are guys that, you know, they specialize. Well, they may love jazz, or they may love blues, or they may love classical music, or whatever their favorite thing is, but they put that completely aside, wipe their slate, their mind clean. They come into a session, and no matter what sort of music it is, they adapt to play that music, and they do it instantly. They were excellent sight readers. They had to be when parts were written out. They weren't always written out, by the way, and that's where it even got more complicated. It was one thing for a wonderful violin player to come in and see a chart by Quincy Jones and then play it the first time down perfectly. He would look at it before they did a take. He would just look at it and see the notes, and then when they said go, he already had played it in his mind, and they would play it. That's why they were able to do it in one take, because he had already done it in his mind. But going back to the Wrecking Crew and this set of guys, these guys, whether they read music or didn't read music, many times in the rock sessions, for instance, like The Beat Goes On, the rhythm section didn't have any music. So they had to make up something. So a record producer or arranger would say, okay, I want you to do, give me something that sort of sounds like this, and I want it to swing this way, you know, and he'll click his fingers. Maybe he'll hum a line. I'd like you to do something like ba, 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 ba. And the guy said, oh, let me just try something. How does this sound? And the man would pick up his guitar and say, listen to this, and he'd play something, and the producer would say, that sounds great, that's great, do that. Or if he didn't like it, he'd say, no, can you change it a little bit, or, you know. And the Wrecking Crew guys were wonderful at coming up with ideas to help the arrangers, producers, and artists do
yes.
that. And that's what made them stand out from even the other studio musicians. And so we all contributed to helping them make their hit records. You know.
Was there anyone you wanted to work with you didn't get to?
Yes.
Oh, really?
No, a big yes. I always wanted to work. I always wanted to work with. Oh, my brain.
It's okay.
It's terrible.
Da 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 da.
Well, Muddy Waters is one of them, and Muddy Waters, but B.B. King. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I'm sorry, I went blank there.
That's okay.
Too much pressure.
Yeah, right. B.B. King.
I always wanted to work with B.B. King. He's my favorite blues guy forever.
I worked with him in Chicago.
Oh, I'm really jealous. I'm really jealous.
Golly.
Yeah, Muddy Waters and B.B. King. Man, those guys were just, they were just wonderful. And I wanted to work with them. I wrote a song for B.B. King.
Really?
Once, yeah. You know, later on in the 90s, I wrote a song for him. And he didn't take it. I mean, he heard it. He turned it down, you know.
Tell us about knowing Hal Blaine and Tommy Tedesco. I mean, will there ever be anyone like them again? I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't either, and that's probably not good to say, but...
Yeah, they were really individualistic. I mean, there certainly are drummers that can take their place, but they had individual styles.
That style,
well,
that's
you know,
the word.
Or they had non-styles. You know, Tommy Tedesco was the king of changing the style, whatever was needed at any minute. If you wanted to hear flamenco, he played flamenco. If you wanted to sound like Jimi Hendrix, he sounded like Jimi Hendrix. You wanted to play blues, he was right there. It didn't make any difference. So it's almost like he didn't have any style of his own. He was just infinitely great at laying down any type of
But you
of
were
style.
Like that.
Yes, I was.
You yeah. were like that yeah. with the yeah. piano. I want to read. I want you to tell me what this instrument is. I'm a French horn player. I was a great kisser. That's what that means. Of course, I had to study classical piano. Organ, we know. What's a clavinet?
Clavinet is an electric instrument. It sounds vaguely like a harpsichord, like an electric
okay.
harpsichord. It's sort of
which you also played. Electric yes. piano and synthesizer. But piano, organ, clavinet. I went, what? Mm. I have a 4'11" clavichord, my piano at home. But I didn't know what a clavinet was. We're visiting. Boy, are you lucky, Joey Pals, that you tuned in today. Michelle Rabini. Did your mother and father want a girl? My dad wanted a boy. He named me after Joe DiMaggio.
Well, of course, I don't know what was really in their hearts, but I can tell you this much. They named me Michelle, and I asked my mother once, why did you name me Michelle?
Right.
And she said, well, we thought we were going to have a girl, and we had decided on that name. And then when you popped out, we had a problem because we hadn't really considered a name for a man, for a boy.
See?
As a matter of fact, on my birth certificate, they wrote down my first name as M-I-C-H-E-L-E. They put an E on the end of it. And so that went down to the county records in Los Angeles. And that's the feminine spelling of the name. And I was a girl until I was about 3 or 4 years old, until my mother went back down to the county records and officially signed an affidavit and crossed out the E on the end of my name. So it became Michelle, and I became a boy once again.
There's a movie there. Okay, when we come back from our Red Hot Treasure Chest, we'll talk about the future in the book. There's a book. Okay, Joey Pals, if you're near your phones, I've got presents for you.